Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Spotify opens up its algorithm for a fee. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, and this is a bit of a scoop, the pan-European independent music trade group Impala announced a partnership with CMU Insights.
Well, you say it's a bit of a scoop, but it was in the CMU Daily and elsewhere last Wednesday.
Yeah, all right. It's not our scoop. I mean, it's probably a podcast scoop.
Who knows?
How many podcasts have discussed it?
Have you been listening to every single music business podcast in the last week?
Of course I have, as ever. I'm not going to name them. I've listened to all of them.
None of them. Oh, which is, we've got a scoop. Yes.
Do you know what I have listened to before you get to that? We discussed a few weeks ago the Fyre Festival podcast that Billy McFarland has set up. And we sort of joked about if we discuss it in the intro, people might go and listen to it and then not listen to our show. But I should say I have been listening to the Dumpster Fyre podcast. And I am telling you now, you should not listen to it. It is one of the most boring podcasts I have ever listened to. Do not listen to it. Nothing interesting has been said in it yet. Three episodes in.
You were saying the other day that there's two things. One, the general narrative of the whole series is poor Billy McFarland.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
Jailed for just trying to put on a festival and defrauding some people in the process.
Oh, no, he does. He repeatedly says that he's done bad things. He recognises he's done bad things. He recognises that he is rightly in jail for the bad things that he's done. But then he just talks about how he's a changed man and he wants to do things that are good now. Just use his platform as a force for good. And he just goes on and on and on about that. Particularly as I think we discussed before, because he's in prison, he can only record in 15-minute chunks. And I think he forgets what he said, so he repeats himself a lot. But because it's so arduous to get these interviews in 50-minute chunks, they don't edit anything out. So there's just so much repetition.
Yeah, that was that was going to be the second thing that you said earlier this week that I was going to say. Yes, so he just keeps saying the same thing again because it's the same 15-minute interview on a loop recorded several times.
I mean, not the second episode, he wasn't there because the second episode was about how he's been put in solitary confinement for doing this podcast. So that was sort of interesting, but didn't warrant a 30-minute podcast. The other thing, the one interesting thing he has said, well, one, he did sort of imply that he's planning to do the Fyre Festival again when he gets out of prison, which is not a good idea. But also, he's launched, as well as doing this podcast, he's launched a line of merchandise alongside it, which he described as islandware inspired by solitary confinement. Which I don't know who is going to wear that.
And is that how he's planning on making money out of this podcast so he can pay off the people he owes money to as a result of legal action?
Yes, he owes people $26 million, so he's going to use podcast advertising and selling whatever these clothes are. He did say that when it was pointed out that it might take quite a long time to make $26 million out of this, he did say, oh, well, you know, I'm not focusing on the full amount. I'm just focusing on getting it bit by bit and eventually paying it back. He recognises that podcasts don't pay, especially if you make just such a boring podcast that people won't listen to it long term.
You know how you mentioned that you listen to every single music business podcast religiously every week?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that any of those other music business podcasts, when about to plug something that they themselves are involved in...
Yeah.
Rather than going ahead and doing the self-promotion, would go on a massive tangent about another podcast? Or is that...
Yeah. Well, no, I think that's what you know, marks us out from the others.
That's what's unique.
What people tune in for.
About Setlist.
Torpedoing our own promotion.
When we've cleverly engineered it.
Go on, talk about it then. What are you doing?
So we can talk about ourselves. But this is genuinely exciting because, as you say, we have teamed up with Impala through our CMU Insights consultancy unit for a big program called One Step Ahead. And basically what we're going to be doing in partnership with Impala and their digital committee and a network of people who know lots of stuff about the music business and streaming and licensing and marketing all over Europe, is we're going to be putting out a series of reports over the next 12 months covering a number of different topics, all about helping independent music companies, whether they are, you know, some of the biggest indie labels in the business, or indeed smaller grassroots indie labels which are run part-time by entrepreneurs or by artists. We're going to help those people through the network of different independent music trade bodies across Europe, which are all affiliated to Impala. Through that network, we're going to help those people get to grips with all the key trends and developments in different aspects of digital music, making sure that they have the information and the knowledge and the updates that they need to be getting the most out of digital today. But it is called One Step Ahead, and each of those reports is sort of going to have a bit of an overview of what's happening right now, but then also looking ahead and saying, well, this is definitely going to be happening in the next 12 months, and do you know what? This could be coming a few years down the line. So that's what it's all about, and we will no doubt keep you up to date through CMU. And for those of you who are either Impala members or you're member of an organisation which is an Impala member, do look out for updates going out as and when those reports are available to you, and there'll be some other stuff going on alongside too. So that was our big announcement this week. We are so busy on the CMU Insights side of CMU that we don't talk about that much on Setlist. I'm only saying that kind of to let you know that we're going to be doing quite a lot of plugging in the intros of podcasts coming up, because we've got lots of exciting things coming up. So I think you can expect, it may well become part of the format that with Setlist, we begin every episode telling you about a fantastic project that we're working on, and Andy Malt will try
and
his
best. I might
best.
Just break into it with a review of the latest episode of Dumpster Fire.
Yeah.
Which, who knows, might get into, might actually talk about Fire Festival at some point.
So Andy Malt will do his best to scupper my attempts to tell you about the exciting projects that we're working on. But, and we must stress this, it's very important, none of this is really what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we will be discussing Live Nation's optimism, despite announcing that its summer revenues were down 95%. But first, Spotify has announced that it is piloting a new service that will allow artists and labels to influence the algorithm that selects what music is played when users use the streaming platform's autoplay or personalised radio functionality. And while some have welcomed this development, the costs associated with it and the way in which they're collected have proven controversial.
Yeah, and who doesn't love a little bit of controversy? But before we get to the controversy, let's just talk a little bit about the Spotify algorithm. And obviously all the streaming services have their own algorithms, just like social
everything
media.
Has an algorithm. I think we've got, have we got an algorithm?
Do we have an algorithm in any of our many operations? I don't know. No, we don't. If we had an algorithm for this podcast, it wouldn't be taking the slightly nonsensical route than it is. Unless it was a nonsensical podcast algorithm, I suppose. Who knows? Maybe secretly there is a data crunching algorithm behind this chaos. But services like Spotify have algorithms, and basically there are various ways in which that algorithm is being used by a service like Spotify to identify and signpost and recommend and play music for users based on all sorts of different criteria. So I suppose if we think about the Spotify algorithm, I mean, the most obvious way in which that algorithm is used is possibly those high-profile playlists like Discover Weekly, which are machine-curated playlists, so that everybody who's a Spotify user gets a personalised Discover Weekly playlist. So unlike lots of the other playlists that are available on Spotify, where a human being has put them together with Discover Weekly, obviously, because, you know, they couldn't have human beings curating 240 million different Discover Weekly playlists. So a machine is doing
it.
No,
I think that's just short-sighted and lacks ambition.
So the algorithm is compiling Discover Weekly for each person, but then it's doing other stuff too. I mean, for example, autoplay. So some Spotify users won't know what this is because they turned it off. Other Spotify users will very much know what this is because they didn't turn it off. I think you have to turn it off. Or do you have to turn it on? I can't remember.
I believe you have to turn it off, although it's so long since I turned it off, I don't know.
I have it on. Do you not have it on?
No, I hate that thing. If I want to get to the end of an album and the album stops, and I don't want it to carry on playing stuff for me, I will choose what I'm going to listen to next. Thank you very much.
Well, I have autoplay on. And so basically what happens with autoplay is if you've picked a specific album or indeed a playlist and you set it to play and then it plays all the tracks in that album or that playlist and it gets to the end, rather than stopping and delivering you some glorious silence, it just carries on playing music. And it will play you music partly based on the album you've just listened to and the artist you've just listened to or the playlist you've just listened to. And then it will crunch all of these other bits of data to try and play you music that it thinks you will like. Then there's the personalized radio bit, which again, I think there are lots of Spotify users who don't even really know what that is because they've never clicked on the button that says, I think it is called radio, isn't it? That's what they call that functionality.
I believe so.
In Spotify.
It's a long time since I clicked on that.
So obviously that is kind of like what Pandora and iHeart do in the US. If you have services like Pandora and iHeart, they are personalized radio services. They are not fully on-demand services. I mean, they do have fully on-demand options, but that's not what the main service is with Pandora and iHeart Radio in the US. They are services where you tell it the name of an artist or maybe the name of a track that you like, and then it plays you a personalized constant feed of music that it thinks you will like because of what you said at the start. And that's obviously not core to Spotify or Apple or Deezer, but they do offer that service. And certainly in the early days of streaming, people used to talk about that while the early adopters of streaming don't really want personalized radio, they see that as being an inferior service because I know what I want to listen to and I'm going to tell you what I want to listen to and I'm going to set up my own playlist because you know what? I'm a really good curator. I don't want a machine telling me what to listen to. Whereas more mainstream music fans who actually in the olden days were more likely to listen to the radio than have all their CDs and vinyl in alphabetical order and programming a Saturday evening deciding what they're going to listen to would actually just prefer to press a button and have music play. Now, I must admit, that's something we used to talk about a few years ago, and I've not checked in on the stats since more mainstream users started using services like Spotify and Apple, and I guess particularly the Amazon services, they are very much pitching at more mainstream consumers. Has that proven to be true, that those people are making more use of personalized radio functionality? But the point here is that the algorithm is in charge of personalized radio. And actually at Spotify, the algorithm's getting involved in other ways. So for example, some of the human curated playlists also have some algorithm stuff going on. And so how it works with that is a human being would curate a playlist like they would, you know, so like the Rap Caviar playlist or whatever, they create a playlist. But rather than then just putting it live and everybody who subscribes to that playlist or goes to that playlist getting the same tracks in the same order, the algorithm then filters. So we could both subscribe to the same playlist, but we would see slightly different versions of the playlist because the algorithm would filter. And that is something that in a relatively recent interview with Forbes magazine, I think the co-head of music at Spotify based in the US called Jeremy Ehrlich, he referred to that sort of hybrid human machine curated playlist as algatorial. I thought you'd like that.
Oh, God.
That's why I wrote it down. I must remember to tell Andy that. So the algatorial...
Don't say it again.
...playlists where it's human curated, but the algorithm is interfering. But the point of all of this is to say that the algorithm...
Do they call it interfering? Is that how they pitch it?
I'm sure that's what it says on the Spotify blog. So the point is that the Spotify algorithm is very powerful and it's becoming increasingly powerful because more elements of the Spotify service are being algorithm driven. And there are some cynics who I have met at music conferences, not this year, obviously, because there haven't been any, but last year when I still went to music conferences, I met a couple of people. I'm not going to name them. Couple of people who their prediction was that as the algorithm gets ever more sophisticated and we get slightly less squeamish with the idea that machines do curation because surely humans can do it better. Well, the prediction that these people were making to me was that at some point in the next few years, the Spotify's and Apples of this world will sack all of their playlists and everything will become entirely algorithm driven. And the sideline to that is obviously one thing that's happened in the music industry in recent years is that record companies, etc., have put a lot of effort into building relationships with the human beings who are curating playlists, whether they are Spotify employees, Apple employees, Amazon employees, or they're third-party curators who create playlists. We spend a lot of time building these relationships, but it might turn out you don't need those relationships because Everything's going to be algorithm driven in the future, which kind of does bring us back to the story we're talking about today, because that then poses the question for labels, which is, well, can you influence the Spotify algorithm?
And the answer is maybe, possibly in the future. But there's certainly, this pilot scheme is starting in the US to see if such a thing would work. And so it will allow artists to put forward tracks that they think the algorithm should be selecting to basically have that done. Spotify has stressed that this won't simply be artists being able to put forward all of their tracks and then the algorithm goes, sure, and starts playing all of their tracks to everyone. There will still be a level of quality control, and if a track isn't right, it won't go in just because an artist or a label has said it should do, but it will highlight tracks that artists and labels think the algorithm should be pushing forward. And that's probably less because it's the new single, because the algorithm's probably going to be picking up on that sort of thing anyway. It seems more to be for tracks that are going viral or are in some way significant from the artist's catalogue at any given time. So you might find that a track, I don't know, it gets used in an advert, or for some reason it starts getting talked about online. Maybe it goes viral on TikTok, or there's something happens in the news that makes it relevant that isn't therefore necessarily going to be noticed by the algorithm. And you can push forward tracks in those circumstances to capitalize on what's going on in the wider world.
Yeah, and in this blog post where they were introducing this new service, I mean, as you say, they were very keen to stress that this isn't a case of you can push your music into people's feeds and have complete control over it. They talked about how the algorithm consults, well, they said thousands of different bits of data when it's deciding what music to recommend. They call those signals. So there's thousands of signals. So, I mean, that includes obvious stuff like, you know, what music you've listened to before, what genre that music is, what music you listen to a lot, what music you tend to skip when it pops up in a playlist, the language of the lyrics that the music you listen to, and things like the tempo of the music, the mood of the music, but then also comparing that with what people who have similar musical tastes, what they're doing. These are all things that it considers. Time of day is one thing that it considers, they say. So, it's considering all of these things, and basically what they're saying is, well, when we're considering all of that, actually, it seems to us that another thing we should be considering is those things you've just said. This track has gone viral on TikTok. This track has just had a big sync. This track is approaching its 20th anniversary. This track has a documentary coming out about it. This track, the band are headlining a big festival. These sorts of things. So yes, it's about giving the opportunity for, they talk about artists, but I mean, really, it's probably going to be labels and management companies basically being able to come into the system and saying, okay, of all the tracks that we have on your platform, this one we think should be prioritized in the algorithm because there's a reason why it is of the moment. And I think your point about the potential here for catalog is a really interesting point, because obviously Spotify already has its playlist pitching tool, so that when you have a new release, you can pick all the new music that's coming out on an album, you can pick the single, and then you can go into Spotify for Artists and say to Spotify, this is the single, and then push it to the human curators who are compiling the playlists. So that already exists, but that is very much skewed towards new music. Whereas, as you say, with this new service, I mean, maybe you are trying to use it for the single, but actually, it will be more interesting to use it for stuff in your catalogue that, for some reason, is suddenly newsworthy again.
So that all seems quite positive and actually serving something that artists and labels have been asking for, having greater control over what music shows up in playlists that are generated by the algorithm. So where does the controversy come in? The controversy comes in when you get to payment for this service, because this is not a free service. Whereas the playlist pitching tool you mentioned is a free service, it just means that you can get a track in front of Spotify's human curators. In this case, it's a marketing tool that Spotify is selling. It's not going to be for free. And how it's paid for is where the controversy lies. Well, first, the fact that it is paid for is controversial as well, because some people have suggested it looks a bit like payola. But how it's paid for has also been controversial, because you won't pay a fee for this. You will accept a lower royalty on the track that you've pushed forward.
Yeah, and I guess the weird thing, I mean, as you say, there are two levels of controversy here. Some people are just annoyed by the concept that this is a paid-for service rather than a free service. Why is that? Well, Spotify is adding to its menu of services that it sells to labels. It's another revenue stream. So you could be cynical and say, well, it's because Spotify wants to grow its paid for marketing services because it's a useful new revenue stream for Spotify. You could be more pragmatic and say, well, if it was free, what's to stop labels from saying everything in our roster is a priority this week? and then it wouldn't work, would it? But yes, so there's some controversy around it being a paid for service in general. But then, yes, the way they are proposing that you would pay for it has in itself been controversial, even though I think Spotify would argue that they were trying to be nice with that idea that rather than you paying upfront fee, you basically offer a discount on any streams that are then enabled by the algorithm based on this information. Because they would basically say, well, the reason we've done that is because if you had to pay a grand upfront, then immediately only bigger record companies that have marketing budgets could afford to do that. Whereas by doing it this way, it's open to everybody because, yes, you're taking a hit on money down the line, but you're not having to pay money up front. So I think Spotify would say, we thought we were being artist and indie label friendly with this approach, but it is kind of bad timing in a way, and you don't know whether Spotify didn't realize that, or they don't care, or they feel that they shouldn't allow debates going on elsewhere to stop the development of their tools. But of course, a big debate in recent months, certainly here in the UK, but elsewhere in the world as well, has been around the rates that streaming services pay when music is streamed. And obviously, that debate always focuses on Spotify, partly because Spotify is the biggest, partly because when you average out per stream royalty rates across a platform, because Spotify has free users as well as paying users, because Spotify is bigger in some emerging markets where subscription fees are less, because Spotify has sold more family plans than quite a lot of its competitors, once you average it out across the platform, Spotify's per stream rate, remember, there isn't a per stream rate, but if we make one by averaging it out, Spotify's per stream rate always comes out less, certainly, than Apple. So there's been a big debate, hasn't there, over the summer, that streaming rates aren't big enough, they're too low, they should be higher. So whether or not you agree with that argument, and as we've discussed at length on Setlist, it's a much more complex argument than a lot of people think, but whatever you think about that argument, to arrive in the middle of that debate with a proposal that we've come up with a way to pay you even less, you can see why it was going to be a little bit controversial in some quarters.
Yeah, because the headlines in the reporting of these stories have almost exclusively been Spotify is trying to pay artists less again. And it's, whereas you say Spotify clearly was thinking, yeah, this would be a nice thing to put forward for people to do. And it's been reported fairly negatively, certainly in the way headlines are written. And partly, I guess, there are reasons why you could see it as controversial. One, you don't like the idea that this is payola. And I suppose that depends, again, whether you see Spotify as a competitor to radio or retail, because payola, which is paying radio stations to play your tracks, is, well, illegal in some places and certainly frowned upon in others. Whereas in retail, it's not unusual to pay maybe to have some shelves right at the front of a record shop and your record right up front when people come into the shop. And you could either, you know, that you could pay a flat fee for that, or you could offer a discount on the CDs or vinyl or whatever that is sold in the shop. The other controversy is, I suppose, people would say that if you are taking a royalty cut on your most popular track, that's probably the one that's going to be making you money. And so reducing the royalties that you're getting on that is counterproductive. Although Spotify could argue a number of things there. One is that if your track becomes a lot more popular as a result of this, your overall revenues will be going up as a result of you doing this. And it could also say that this would just be the royalties on the streams that the algorithm generates. It wouldn't be. So if someone listens to your track once on a playlist, really likes it, adds it to their library, and then plays it loads and loads and loads from their library, you get a higher royalty rate than the algorithmically generated ones. So that's another argument in favour of it. And I think another thing, and maybe you say, like, you know, Spotify must have known that this is a bad time Although, would there ever be a good time to come out and say, hey, we've got this new service and all you have to do is accept less money from us? But, I mean, right now, it does seem like quite a bad time to do that. But they probably also know that people will use this. And in the long term, they're going to do it anyway. And they get a bit of bad press about it now, but it's going to continue. And maybe down the line, some people might talk positively about it. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, in my social feeds, once this was announced, there were plenty of people saying, payola, pay for play. How dare they suggest we cut the rates? So plenty of people were saying that, certainly artists and songwriters, but some industry people too. But actually, it was interesting that there were some people in my social feeds who were saying, actually, I think this is quite a good idea. And those people were mainly music marketeers. They were people who their job is to get people listening to music. So it was interesting that the marketeers were seeing this as a good idea and kind of recognizing that, while in radio, pay for play definitely frowned upon, I mean, certainly in the 90s, in the heyday of the CD, labels were always spending money with retailers or giving discounts to retailers to get their music in front of people. So I think some of the marketeers are more pragmatic in saying, actually, we can do some maths, we can work out what hit we're going to take, and it may well be worth it if it's going to make sure that the right tracks are going out through the algorithm, bearing in mind what I said before, the algorithm is getting more and more powerful on a platform like Spotify. So there you go. Did we present some balance there?
Yeah, although there is one other controversial point, which is more probably a matter of messaging, which is that Spotify has come out and announced this thing, and they said, basically, there's a fee for it that you'll pay with your royalties, but they haven't been very clear about what the fee is, for how long you'll be required to take a cut on your royalties. I mean, is that, do you then just take a cut on your royalties forever on that track? Is there a cut-off point when you bring in enough money to pay for the service and then you go back up again to a higher royalty rate? And that is something they haven't really gone into, and probably they should. I mean, maybe they, because they're piloting it, they don't want to say this is the fee for this service because they're still working it out. But really, by not talking about that side of it and, you know, what the financial cost of it is, they have just had to come out and say, hey, you can have this in return for less money, and left it at that.
Yeah, I guess the issue there was they are clearly still experimenting on this. I mean, it's very early days. It would just be a pilot in the US, initially just impacting personalized radio and autoplay, not the playlists. And I suppose they're in the position where the minute they start reaching out to labels to get involved in this pilot, it's going to leak, isn't it? And then everyone will start talking about it. So therefore, let's get the news out before it starts leaking. But then the flip side is, but the experiment hasn't happened yet, so we haven't quite figured out how we're going to charge it. So yeah, tricky situation. But well done, Spotify, for fanning that flame around streaming royalties and how they're just not good enough.
And finally, last week, Live Nation issued its latest round of financial data in its latest investor update for the last quarter. And it was very, very positive. They talked about all sorts of things. They talked about how much demand there still is for live entertainment. They talked about what their great plans for the future, the changes to their systems and their technology that was going to get live music up and running again next year. And then they also had a little chat about money, which, I mean, you could say that looked a little bit bad.
Yeah, this was really a financial update, and the headline financial figures were very depressing. I mean, not surprising at all, obviously, because this was another quarter of the COVID shutdown, not as extreme a shutdown in many places as the preceding quarter, but nevertheless, pretty much in much of the world, live music was not happening over the summer quarter. So therefore, the fact that Live Nation's revenues year on year were down 95%, which equated to a $319 million loss, not a surprise, but nevertheless, pretty depressing. But because they weren't surprising, even though they were very negative, that was how, in its official statements around all of this, Live Nation was able to say, well, that is what it is. And to be fair, Michael Rapino despite then trying to talk up some positives. I mean, he did say to his investors, there have been no major changes in our business conditions or outlook over the past 3 months. And while we see signs of promise around the world as some live events return, most regions we operate in continue to have various restrictions on live events. So, you know, quite upfront about that. But because everyone knew this was coming, and I mean, quarter three wasn't quite as bad as quarter two, but I mean, still pretty bad. Well, pretty bad. What am I talking about? Very bad.
Yeah, because quarter two was down 98%, and that equated to losses of $568 million. So that quarter three, considerably better, you could say. although losing close to $900 million in 6 months is, well, it's not going to make many people very happy, is it?
And given those losses and the ongoing costs and the fact that we still don't really know when live music's coming back, down the bottom of the investor update, just above all of the figures that you get in these things, there was some chatter about how Live Nation has lots of cash reserves, it has a good debt facility, it's really doing well in managing its costs, it's taking advantage of as many government schemes around the world as it can to keep those costs down. So it was talking about all of that. But I mean, as you alluded to, a big chunk of Michael Rapino's statement to investors was trying to look beyond quarter three, and if we're being honest, quarter four of 2020, and if we're being really honest, beyond quarter one of 2021, because it does feel like now, when you talk to a lot of people in the live industry, people are looking at March now as being when things might start to improve. It's not that we're going to go back to full-on shows and festivals in March, but that maybe the COVID restrictions start to come down. Maybe there's new testing systems in place that means we can start to increase the capacity. So that is the hope. I mean, we should stress there are some pessimists in the live sector who are saying March 2022.
Yeah.
but the optimists are hoping for March 2021. And I guess it was in that context that a lot of what Michael Rapino was talking about was how there was still a huge appetite for live music as soon as we can get shows back at a viable capacity. Clearly, people are going to come. People are not returning their tickets in the main where shows have been postponed. They're holding on to their tickets. Sales for tickets for next year's festivals are doing very well, despite the insecurities about whether or not they will happen. And then he also talked about the technologies and the systems they're putting in place so that when we get to that point, which we will get to at some moment, where there are still COVID restrictions, but we can start operating again in a profitable way, but we will still have lots of COVID-y rules that we have to abide by. So yeah, it was all talking about everyone is desperate to come back to our shows as soon as we can make that happen, and as soon as we can do it in a commercially viable way, we've got all the tech and the systems in place to make that happen, was kind of the summary of what he was saying.
Yeah, he was saying that there were two things. There's strong sales for shows that have already gone on sale, and the number of people asking for refunds on postponed shows has been low throughout the pandemic. So only 17% of people globally have asked for their money back on their tickets, which means a lot of people are sitting at home eager to get to that show they bought tickets for, or they've forgotten that they bought tickets for them. One or other of the two. To Live Nation, I suppose, at this point, it doesn't really matter which. But they also said that 95% of fans are planning to return to live music events when restrictions are lifted, which is the highest point of confidence since the start of the pandemic. Because I think we discussed before, there was a survey about the US live music industry where people were definitely not that confident. And a lot of people thought they were going to wait quite a while before they would be comfortable going back to a live music venue. So that is an improvement. He singled out one particular festival, EDC Las Vegas, which sold out in less than 24 hours at a higher capacity than the previous event. And in the UK, he said that Reading, Creamfields and the Isle of Wight festivals were all ahead of where they were in terms of sales at this time the previous year. So lots of positive talk, which is, I mean, you have to have lots of positive, what can you do? But they certainly seem to think there's going to be something of a boom in live music when live music comes back.
And as for when that's going to happen, I mean, nobody knows. Michael Rapino doesn't know, he's not claiming to know, we simply don't know. You know, are we talking about March as being when things can slowly start to resume? Are we talking about longer than that? And obviously, it's going to vary from country to country. You also have the issue that in those countries, and there are some countries where already COVID is down, lockdown restrictions are down, shows are slowly returning, but we also have the international travel restrictions, don't we? So for artists touring the world, even if there are countries where they have a fan base where in theory they could do a commercially viable show, that's no use if they can't get there, or if they would have to quarantine for 14 days when they arrived in the country. So, you know, there were all of these issues. But another little bit of optimism in Mike Rapino's statement to the investors. He said, "We are encouraged by progress on testing technology, treatments and vaccines, which helps us build our plans. We still expect shows at scale next summer." Quite optimistic, but recognise that the exact timeline of this return will vary by region, and so we continue to focus on remaining flexible.
So that's a positive note to go out on. Let's leave it there. That's the end. Before anyone says anything cynical or downbeat, that is it for this episode of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate, review, tell all of your friends. Obviously, you can't tell them in person. Now, certainly in the UK, where we're just into a brand new lockdown, lockdown two, it's super fun. But I suppose you can, if you're going to work still, then maybe you can tell someone in person. Or if you're going for a walk with one other person and maybe a child, tell the adult, not the child. Children, according to our data, do not enjoy this podcast. But yeah, tell people about the show. And when we can get outside again, maybe we'll tell you in person about it. Although if you're listening, you already know. I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't know. Talk about it. Talk about it to people. Phone someone. Zoom someone. That's the hip thing, isn't it? That's what all the kids are doing. Zooming. Zoom someone today and tell them about the Setlist podcast.
Hopefully at some point, very soon, we'll just be able to pay Spotify to have its algorithm shove this podcast into everybody's ears, even if they don't want it. And then we'll have to stop begging people to recommend our podcast at the end of the programme.
Yeah, but they've got that Your Daily Drive thing that puts spoken word in amongst music, don't they? And that's shit. So I'm not confident on that. Oh no, we went downbeat. Oh, it was going so well. Anyway, Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.